Welcome back to Current State. This is 90.5 WKAR, and I'm Mark Bayshore. When President-elect Donald Trump nominated Michigan's Betsy DeVos for Secretary of Education, it led to an array of different reactions. Some applaud the nomination and praise Betsy DeVos for her years of philanthropy, activism, and hard work fighting for school choice. Others say her approach to education is flawed and could be damaging if enacted at a national level. Joining us by phone today to look more closely at what we might expect after Betsy DeVos's confirmation, we've got Rebecca Jacobson. Rebecca's co-director of MSU's Education Policy Center and an associate professor of education here at Michigan State. Hello, Rebecca.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And I'm under the impression here we connected with Gary Nayert a minute ago and we lost him, so we're trying to reconnect with Gary Nayert. Gary is executive director of the Great Lakes Education Project, or GLEP. That is a nonprofit that advocates for school choice and where, we will point out, Ms. DeVos serves on the board. Rebecca, I'll start with you. Betsy and Dick DeVos are both ardent about charter schools and a voucher system here. I was going to ask Gary Nayert this question, and we'll let Gary chime in when we reconnect here with him. But fewer of our listeners probably understand the voucher system than charter schools. So let's start by making sure we have a good understanding of how a voucher system works. Can you help us out with that?
Sure. Well, voucher systems are implemented in about 45 different cities across the country, and there's only one state that has sort of a statewide voucher program. And they do vary, just like charter school laws vary from state to state. But generally, the key difference is that vouchers enable students to select a school, private school, religious school. In some ways, you could think of the student as receiving a check that they could take to any school, and there's no requirement that it be a public school that is required to follow some of the rules that our schools today are, like a common standardized test, certain requirements for hiring teachers that are qualified according to state rules. Private schools, as we know, are exempt from all of those rules. And so these vouchers enable parents to select those schools instead of just remaining within the public system.
But clarify for us, could a family with a voucher also use it somehow on a public school?
Certainly. The idea of a voucher is that you could take it to just about any school, homeschool, private school, cyber school, religious school. Vouchers really try to open up to the entire range of schools.
But we are talking public money here, to be clear.
Yeah. Exactly.
You and others have expressed concerns about this voucher system. Talk to us here just a little bit about why you find it problematic.
Well, I think that there's a couple of things. You know, first and foremost is an abandonment of a public education system where we do have some sort of agreement on what we think our children should be learning, that next generation, that the public has some way of oversight, right? So if we don't like our representatives, we have the opportunity to voice those concerns to them. We could vote for different representatives. Within a private system, a privatized system, there's very little way to redress, you know, if the public is unhappy with the choices that an individual family is making. So that is, sort of a fundamental concern that remains for me, is what does it mean for a system of public education if we allow students to choose very different kinds of education, private, that sort of thing.
I imagine if Gary Nayert were here, and we're still trying to connect with him here in Washington, I imagine if Gary were here, he would say something to the effect that if a private school were found to be insufficient, that the people who send their children to that private school would find some other option. That's at the heart of the choice argument here. How would you respond to that?
Certainly, and I think, you know, for many of us that have the time and resources to invest into looking at what's the best option for my kid and what's the best match, we might be able to make some really good choices. However, for many parents who lack that time, who lack that knowledge, who lack the resources to be able to do it, some of our most needy children then may have parents who are not equipped to make those choices. And certainly the research that's gone on in the public choice sector within charter schools demonstrates that oftentimes parents choose not because of school quality, but because of location, because of demographics, sometimes leading to even more concentrated forms of segregation because parents may say, oh, well, my kid is X type. I want them to go to schools with other kids that are the same type. So parents don't always choose, as we know from, you know, football craze in Texas and Friday Night Lights. Parents sometimes choose schools for very different reasons than what's the best educational outcomes I can get for my child.
I'm told that we've reconnected with Gary Nagert. Gary, can you hear me?
I sure can, Mark. Thanks.
Very good. Glad to have you along here today. I'm growing tired of speaking in your stead here, so I'm glad we finally connected with you.
Thank you.
We'll let you speak for yourself here for a minute here. Rebecca has just pointed out that if I can summarize some of your last few comments, Rebecca, she fears that a voucher system really constitutes an abandonment of the public education system, and secondarily fears the lack of accountability that comes with a voucher system, and I think more broadly with charter schools as well. I'm sure you hear that a lot. Respond to those concerns, please.
Well, we think the ultimate accountability system is apparent more so than the government, but nobody chooses a school of choice without doing their homework or at least caring enough to explore the options. So we know that and believe that parents have the best interests of their kids at heart, and we wouldn't abdicate that responsibility to government bureaucrats, and we certainly wouldn't say that government bureaucrats should override parents in their decision of where they send their child. But when you talk about vouchers, what you're talking about is creating an opportunity for students whose parents don't have the means to either move to a higher performing suburban school system or pay for the private school tuition. We don't want that child's family situation and zip code, you know, to be the determining factor in what educational opportunities they have. And all of us pay taxes to support a public education, and all of us pay to, you know, have our citizens be educated. So to allow money to follow a child to the school of their choice that's chosen by the parent is our basic tenet, and we think it's a policy goal above all else.
I'm speaking with Gary Nagert, Executive Director of the nonprofit Great Lakes Education Project, and with Rebecca Jacobson, Associate Professor of Education and Co-Director of MSU's Education Policy Center. We're talking about vouchers, charters, and what we might expect from Michigan's Betsy DeVos as Secretary of Education. Rebecca, you pointed out earlier there are 45 American cities and one U.S. state where voucher systems have been implemented here. How much do we know about the performance of those systems?
We know some. It's sometimes challenging to know this, in part because not all states require private schools to take the same test, nor do they always have to release that information. So it can be very difficult to even know how well those students that use those vouchers are doing in those schools. And so, you know, some of my concerns about moving to a privatized choice system that includes vouchers that go to private schools is what sort of requirements will be placed on those schools for receiving that public money? And will private schools be wanting to accept those regulations? Will there even be seats in those high-quality schools that may now have to face regulations that they have avoided and want to avoid? It's part of, you know, how they organize their system.
Gary Nagert, what do you make of the performance of voucher systems where they exist in the United States?
Well, it's well researched that students who exercise school choice, be it a charter school, another traditional public district school, or vouchers, that students go from a lower performing school to a higher performing school. That is generally what the research shows us. Now, to we want to make sure people understand a voucher is rarely not used. It's not something we're talking about universal. You know, that 1.5 million kids in Michigan would get a voucher and they'd be picking their school. I mean, it's the bulk of students historically have gone to traditional public schools, and the bulk of students will do so in the future. The choice argument is only for the people who aren't the right fit for their local district school or are looking for something different or their needs are not being met. It's the exception, not the rule. And I don't think we are advocating, and I don't think people should assume, that we're talking about replacing traditional public education. We're just talking about creating options for those who'd like to seek them out.
Rebecca.
I just wanted to jump in, too. I mean, one of the most recent evaluations of students who participated in the Ohio voucher program actually demonstrated worse performance in math and English language arts that were not just right after a student switch, because we know when kids switch, there's sort of an adjustment period, and so achievement may decline. But those declines actually persisted over time. And in a lot of the choice literature, it's become pretty apparent that there's good schools everywhere and bad schools everywhere across these different types of schools. And so it's not surprising that in many cases, students are ending up in schools that they don't do better. In fact, they may do actually a little bit worse. So I do think we need to be cautious about assuming that a choice leads to higher quality.
I'm hoping we can both all agree that the record on school choice is so far mixed. There are successes to point to. There are failures to point to. Rebecca, is there any way to implement any kind of voucher system that you think might be effective, or should it be abandoned altogether?
I think that choice, as you've talked about, can be both good and bad. And I think that we have learned a lot over how to make a good choice system that still allows the things that we heard from Gary about allowing parents the options to choose one that fits their child better and be engaged in that process. But I do think it should remain within the public system. And I think that that is really important to be public so that we have some oversight of these schools, so that there's some central organization that's able to think about not just, you know, do we have choice, but do we have the right set of choice for our students? Do we even have schools where kids are located? A voucher system doesn't provide any of that sort of central oversight and planning that we've really learned is necessary in order for choice to be successful.
Gary Nair, go ahead and respond to that, please.
Well, I mean, so we're not here to, you know, cause an argument. I mean, it's a philosophical question that people have to wrestle with, whether we want to allow people to use education funds at the school of their choice, public or private, because we have today a public school voucher system in Michigan. Since the passage of Proposal A, roughly $8,000 per pupil, you know, that money follows that child to the public school of their choice, and they can choose any school that is open to enroll them. So the question is only whether we would allow that to be extended to other institutions, private or religious schools. And no one is forced to, you know, utilize choice. No one is forced to, you know, pick a school that no one's assigned to a school. That's the big difference. We have kind of trying to break this monopoly of the traditional public school system. It was broken 20 years ago, and there are folks who just hang on and hang on to the way it had always been and use, you know, the choice argument against parents or families that want to leave the traditional system. But we're saying if for the traditional system, for people who want to use it, it's fine. We need improvement in Michigan in all areas of education. The performance of Michigan's students is well below where it should be for our students to be competitive. But again, I think it's a philosophical decision whether you agree or not agree that the private schools should be part of the mix.
I want to ask both of you in the time that we have left what your expectations are, assuming Betsy DeVos is confirmed. Rebecca, do you expect a really noticeable acceleration of the charter and voucher landscape?
I think that it's sort of hard to predict whether or not the vouchers have long been challenged in many different ways, and even many public votes have voted down vouchers. So it's hard to say whether or not it will really take off. I do certainly think we will see an increased push for choice. I guess I hope that the choice would remain within the public sector to ensure that all schools have to accept all students. I'm very concerned about high-need students that cost more than a voucher would provide. And so who's going to take those students? And will we further concentrate our highest need students into some schools that then have even less resources to deal with? And so I think it's really important for us to think about a system of schooling, and a system requires some sort of oversight and collective planning that can then ensure that we don't just have choice, but we have quality.
Very good. Gary Nayer, I'll give you a chance to respond. What are you expecting here, assuming Betsy DeVos is confirmed?
Well, the two main priority education goals that President-elect Trump has articulated are that he wants to create a federally funded voucher program, especially for at-risk kids, and he wants to reduce the size and scope of the federal footprint on education and return a lot of the power and decision-making back to the states. Those are the two primary pledges he has made. I know that Betsy DeVos supports those and agrees with those, and I think you're going to see probably the most immediate result will be less arguing over the D.C. scholarship program, which is a voucher program in the District of Columbia,
right,
that the president, current president, has been resistant to renew, whereas the Congress has been willing to do so. But I think under a Trump administration with Ms. DeVos as the secretary, you'll see a robust D.C. opportunity scholarship, and these kids won't be dangled like political punching bags, you know, every year trying to decide whether they're still going to be able to go to school or not.
We have to leave it there, Gary. I'm sorry. That's the D.C. Opportunity Scholarship Program that he's talking about there. I've been speaking with Gary Nayert, executive director of the nonprofit Great Lakes Education Project, where Betsy DeVos serves on the board. I've also been speaking with Rebecca Jacobson, co-director of MSU's Education Policy Center. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up on Current State, hundreds of Michigan farmers are wrapping up their annual meeting in Grand Rapids today. The Michigan Farm Bureau has been busy planning its priorities for 2017. We'll talk with the Bureau's Policy Development Chair about what he's been hearing. That's Andy Hagenow, and that's coming up on Current State. Well, new development is rising along Michigan Avenue on Lansing's east side. The framework of what will become the Skyview Apartments is taking shape near the Frandor Shopping Center. Across the street, developers and city officials are working on the mixed-use Red Cedar Renaissance, a $380 million development. There are big plans for the corridor where Lansing, East Lansing, and the MSU campus meet. Another part of the plan aims to clean the stormwater that empties into the Red Cedar River while raising environmental awareness through art. Kevin Lavery of Current State joins me now with more details. What do organizers have in mind, Kevin?
Mark, this particular aspect of the redevelopment has been dubbed Art in the Wild. The idea is to create sculptures in a redesigned wetland setting that convey the importance of something that's so basic to all our lives, and that's water. I spoke with Dr. Melody Angel, who chairs the project. Full disclosure here, she is married to Pat Lindemann, the Ingham County Drain Commissioner, who is tasked with revamping the stormwater system in the Frandor area. I also met up with Teresa Lark. She is the executive director of the Mid-Michigan Environmental Action Council, MIDMIAC. And to really get some perspective on what this project is all about, I asked them to meet me at a very specific spot with a sweeping view. Ladies, we are standing on top of a hill. This is the snow hill in the winter at Rainy Park on the east side of Lansing. It's a little chilly. It's the end of November. It's kind of raw. But we're Michiganders, and so we'll make this work. Why are we standing on top of this hill overlooking the Frandor shopping area, Melody?
Well, this is the area of an environmental restoration project for what is known as the Montgomery Drain, which is a large watershed here that encompasses the Frandor Shopping Center area and an area about a mile north of here. And all that water then from the stormwater runs off into the Red Cedar Golf Course. And as it turns out, it is one of about 235 outlets into the Red Cedar River, and it is the most polluted one. So we are right on the verge of doing some amazing environmental restoration to make it one of the cleanest ones.
Teresa, you're with the Mid-Michigan Environmental Action Council, and how did your group first get involved with the idea of what's going to become Art in the Wild, and why is that really worth the community's time to invest in something like that?
Well, Art in the Wild is the inspiration of Patrick Lindemann, who is our Ingham County Drain Commissioner, and his lovely wife here, Melody Angel, MD. So part of doing this drain project, right now you can't see the stormwater, but it's there, it's underground. He's gonna bring it to the surface and clean it before it gets to the river. And so this whole area that you see right now is gonna be a series of wetlands and ponds and streams and waterfalls, and it's gonna be a tremendous asset to the community. But what he's required to do by the Environmental Protection Agency is he has to meet six minimum measures. One of them is education, public education. How do we get people here? We believe that by putting in art installations and performing arts and a variety of other cultural amenities in through here, that we will bring more people so that they can see what was done and try to understand why we want dense communities, why we want to avoid urban sprawl, and how we're addressing our stormwater to clean it before we dump it into the river.
Okay, and just so that I'm clear, Teresa, this area that we are physically standing on now on top of this hill in Randy Park, this will essentially remain the same. It's what we're looking at across Michigan Avenue.
The hill is gonna be re-engineered. They're gonna be moving a lot of dirt. So the hill's gonna be re-engineered so that the slope will go down the north side that will preserve the snow base during the winter. It also will be a multifunction space, so the summer you can use it as a performance space, something like an amphitheater. But it will not be developed. There will be no box stores. The kiosks that will be here will be art-related and culturally related, heritage-related. It will not be paved. There will be a trail, so I say it won't be paved. There will be a trail, so that and that the city of Lansing likes a certain standard for their trails. So there likely will be a paved trail, but it's just a trail. Part of what will be here, the ponds that we talked about, I believe we're going to be trying to make those fishable. So and I believe they're going to be trying to do if the funding is available, and this might be a grant that the Drain Commissioner's office is looking at, but if that funding does come through, they'll be looking at rebuilding the Red Cedar, this portion of the Red Cedar, so that it can support more fishery habitat. So it really is going at this area from all aspects of the human creature who we are. So as Melody often says, you know, inspire the best of us through imagination, but also, you know, the strong conservation and outdoors ethic that has long been part of Michigan. And this will be, I think, for a cityscape, as you look around and see this, you see the shopping center on one side and housing on the other, it'll be a nice slice of nature right outside their back doors.
We're talking with Teresa Lark with the Mid-Michigan Environmental Action Council and also Dr. Melody Angel, and they are both involved in the Art in the Wild project, which will be happening in the Montgomery Drain area on Lansing's east side near the Frandorf Shopping Center. Melody, tell me something about the artwork that you are soliciting or the in-kind donations you're trying to raise that will eventually be used to create art in this public space.
Well, we're looking to raise about $10 million of private investment, so this will not be coming from the tax base, of private investment to place art in and among this area of environmental restoration for the purpose of teaching about how to keep the river clean. One thing that we're going to be having is a large number of murals sprinkled throughout the walls around Frandor and the new development. We will also be having sculptures of various kinds in and among the wetlands and trails that will be here. The first sculpture that will likely be a keynote sculpture that will be moved to this area that we're still in negotiations on is a piece called The Wind Lord. It is currently in Adado Park. It is in disrepair. There is a committee that is going to be separate from Art in the Wild that is going to be adopting that project and raising about $250,000 to rebuild the base of that into a beautiful bronze
base that will then reflect light up onto the statue. And that statue will likely be moved on top of a beautiful limestone waterfall that will be part of the water treatment to take some of the acid out of the water here in the environmental restoration area, down on the median of Michigan Avenue, just south of Dunham's. And we'll have the Wind Lord, which is an abstract eagle bronze with a bronze base that shoots light up onto it on top of a beautiful limestone waterfall that has a small river going out on from either side of it with water. So that is actually about $1.5 million piece, partly because the artist, who was originally a local artist, Marty Eckinger, has become quite famous now with his artwork. So this is a very valuable piece that looks like will continue to be owned by the City of Lansing, but will likely be moved into this area as part of this installation. We will also then at some point, as we raise funds, be putting out a call for artists to make proposals for art installations that we could have here. Our commitment is to try to favor local artists as much as possible, because we really want to highlight the amazing talent that's available right here in the mid-Michigan area.
Will one piece of art flow into the next? How are all these pieces designed to be thematic, that tells a story, that weaves a message for the viewer?
We would like to have as many pieces as possible actually have some connection to the environment and to water. However, some of them will probably have a strictly artistic message all of their own. What we want to do here is to really be able to get in touch with our imagination and our human spirit, and remember the things that we really care the most about as we come and we contemplate things in this space. Not only do we want to really teach people about the environment, but we want this to improve the quality of life in mid-Michigan for everybody.
Obviously, Frandor itself is a destination. It takes a little more effort to find the park on the other side of the parking lot, and again, what will be on the other side of the street as well. Is the location, in your mind, conducive to having people walk around and study the artwork? I mean, is this going to be accessible, easy to find? Will this be a destination unto itself one day?
I believe it will be a destination unto itself, and we will have the flow of traffic and people facilitated in such a way that there can be easy access to parking. I believe that this will actually improve the economics of the shopping center as well, to bring people not only to the art, but then to go have a bite to eat or go shopping. On the north end of Frandor, north of Joanne's Fabric, south of Red Lobster, and south of Marshall Music, there's a retaining wall all along there. That is going to be made into a vertical water quality wall. So just there is Marshall Music, and then just all the way west of that, all the way to the west end of Red Lobster, there's a retaining wall there about 6 or 8 feet high, and that is going to be made into a year-round green plant wall that's going to have about 800 fountainheads coming out of it. And one of the key features and projects that we're going to be working on, we have an amazing technology to be able to take 3D pictures of a human head and be able to make that into a water fountain. And so we're going to be offering people the opportunity for like $3,000, we haven't set the price yet exactly, to be able to put their face on this wall, which we are thinking possibly of calling the Faces of Lansing. And so we will have people that are able to help make this project possible financially and be able to be part of it in a form of community engagement. We also would like to raise some money to have maybe 20-25 people that are homeless or underserved who can be part of this as well. And then my dream is that we could collaborate with the newspaper, maybe even the radio, and every month or every week feature the really human interest story of one of those people on the wall.
Teresa, tonight, Art in the Wild has a fundraising event at the Broad Art Museum on campus as a kickoff to the next phase. What's happening this evening?
Well, we're very pleased to have the Broad host our holiday celebration. It will be 6 to 9 p.m. tonight. All are welcome. Any who would like to attend, we are going to have live music, hors d'oeuvres. There will be a cash bar available. The gallery will be open for an hour or so people can take advantage of looking around. And if anybody who hasn't seen the Broad, it's a stunning facility and really should come on out.
Teresa Lark is the executive director of MidMEAC, the Mid-Michigan Environmental Action Council. And Dr. Melody Angel is chair of the Art in the Wild Project, which is a subdivision, essentially, of MidMEAC. And we're talking about plans for Lansing's east side and the Frandor area, the Ranny Park area, and the Red Cedar Renaissance area, and how that will become a destination spot one day for public art that conveys an environmental stewardship mission. Melody and Teresa, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
WKAR and Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. Hundreds of farmers from across the state are ending their annual meeting today in Grand Rapids. The Michigan Farm Bureau is looking ahead to the coming spring planting season and beyond. There are a number of issues on the table in 2017, ranging from protecting seasonal migrant laborers to recruiting and mentoring the next generation of food producers. I spoke with Andy Hagenow about these and other topics yesterday. He's the Bureau's Policy Development Director. I asked him to give me an overview of the issues on the minds of Michigan farmers.
You name it. We've talked about the right to repair farm equipment and farm machinery. We've talked a little bit about national dairy policy. We actually passed policy for a limited purpose operator's license. We had a new resolution on the Michigan hop industry.
That's a good overview. Labor and manpower is an issue in agriculture. Michigan relies pretty heavily on seasonal workers every year to plant and harvest fruit crops. Many are migrant workers. Are farmers concerned about having enough help for spring planting in 2017 and then later for the harvest?
Yeah, I believe so. It's been an increasing concern. That's why one of the reasons Michigan Farm Bureau decided to start a labor procurement agency to help along with that, to bring H-2A workers in. It's a bit costlier, costs a little bit more, but it's a guarantee that the folks will be there and everything will be in the correct order and that the help would be there. But yeah, it's always a concern.
How do you see the migrant labor situation shaping up under the Trump administration? Have your members been talking about that?
Not with any real clarity. We're still pursuing, the H-2A path, and everything is sort of in limbo right now because nobody really knows what direction things are going to go.
Has your parent organization, the American Farm Bureau Federation, had any contact with the Trump transition team about legal workers and H-2s?
I couldn't tell you for sure, Mark. I'm sorry. I don't know.
I want to ask you about these limited purpose operators licenses. Prior to 2008, an undocumented worker could get a Michigan driver's license to drive around the farm for work purposes only. That's no longer the case, but I know this has come up again at this meeting. What are you hearing? What are your members saying?
That we'd like to go back to that.
And what was the advantage to that?
Pretty simple. The folks could drive into town and get their groceries. They could drive back and forth to work. They had a way to mobilize their family. That's basically the reason for it.
Why was it taken away?
I think Michigan wanted to comply with the Real ID Act, where a driver's license would be considered a federal ID.
Okay. We're talking with Andrew Hagenow. He's the Policy Development Chairman for the Michigan Farm Bureau, which is wrapping up its annual meeting this week in Grand Rapids. Water is a perennial issue for farmers. The most recent iteration of the Clean Water Rule took effect back in August of last year. Prior to that, farmers were worried about the EPA's Waters of the U.S. clause that would impose stricter regulations on all sorts of waterways. Michigan Farm Bureau opposed it. How's that been impacting Michigan farmers?
Well, it of course has would have an adverse effect because most water bodies in Michigan are all within a watershed, all within a basin, and all connected. We don't have standing water all the time. By that rule becoming law, that would declare virtually all waters in Michigan, all the swamps and streams, as waters of the U.S.
Are Michigan farmers having legal issues with that rule?
Well, the rule isn't in effect yet. But yeah, there could be. Yeah, there almost certainly would be.
Is it much of a topic at your gathering?
We haven't gotten to that one yet. That one is still in limbo. It's been a high priority for the past year or so.
We're talking with Andrew Hagenow. He's the Policy Development Chairman for the Michigan Farm Bureau, which is wrapping up its annual meeting this week in Grand Rapids. I take it much of this year's conference focused on developing young farmers. In general, I guess farmers are an aging population in the U.S. What progress is being made in the United States and in Michigan to attract and to mentor tomorrow's food producers?
Well, there's a lot of progress being made. One of the primary focus for Michigan Farm Bureau is developing the young farmers. That's why we have an outstanding young farmer program in this state. They comprise of several different leadership contests, and there's all the counties have a young farmer program. And there's a lot of opportunities for them to mingle and participate in educational activities.
Is farming still a legacy activity? I mean, that goes on from generation to generation, or is that no longer the case?
Oh, it absolutely is. I don't think most of us see it that way. But it's also an exciting opportunity for folks that haven't farmed before that get an opportunity. You hear stories from those folks that really enjoy the farm life.
I understand a lot of farms in Michigan transition over time, moving from producing one or more crops or products to something completely different. What drives that?
Well, I can tell you that from my own personal experience. I milked cows with my father, and he was ready to retire. And either the labor wasn't available and it was too cost-effective to keep milking cows, so we decided to sell the cows, and of course I couldn't be without livestock very long, so I started raising dairy steers, and I still farm corn, soybeans, and a little bit of hay.
You know, farmers can't operate anything without the right equipment, and I know there's an issue that's emerged this week. Here, you referred to it earlier, the right to repair. Tell us about that.
Well, there is, as technology continues to grow, there's a lot of proprietary information out there to a machinery manufacturer. And, you know, farmers are an independent group of folks, and they've always cherished the ability to repair or enhance their own equipment. And with that increase in technology, that's becoming more difficult because of the lack of access to that proprietary information.
I know hops production is booming here in Michigan, Andrew. You're having your meeting in Grand Rapids, which is really marketing itself as a beer town. What's the future looking like for hops production? Is it onward and upward, or what?
Well, it's definitely onward and upward. Our new resolution would support incentives for breweries to utilize more of the local hops, in fact, in their recipes.
Did climate change come up at the conference at all?
Climate change did come up. I believe the resolution was passed as presented. There wasn't any changes.
And it, you resolved what exactly?
Well, we didn't resolve anything. We agreed that, of course, the climate's changing. It's always been changing. The question is whether it's human-induced, and we don't attempt to answer that. However, we just have the stance that if legislation is being enacted to affect or as a result of some sort of climate change that certain things would be adhered to.
Will anything be happening in 2017 you're looking forward to regarding agriculture?
Yeah, well, we'll be discussing the next Farm Bill, which should be written in 2018.
So the discussion about that will begin in 2017?
I would think so, yes.
What would you like to see in there?
Oh, boy. we haven't really gotten too deep in what to put into the next Farm Bill. So, you know, this last Farm Bill was the first of its kind, putting more of an emphasis on the insurance aspect of crop production instead of direct payments. And aside from having a few wrinkles that we need to work out, I think for the foreseeable future, that'll continue to be the path.
We've been talking with Andrew Hagenow. He's the Policy Development Chairman for the Michigan Farm Bureau, which is wrapping up its annual meeting this week in Grand Rapids. Andrew, thanks for joining us. Best of luck in 2017.
Hey, well, thank you very much.
It's Current State on WKAR. Today marks the 28th World AIDS Day. East Lansing's MSU Museum has been loaned a portion of the famed AIDS Memorial Quilt, part of the NAMES Project. The museum's Mary Worrell tells Current State's Jamie Paisley the AIDS quilt panels have traveled around quite a bit, first in San Francisco, then to Washington, D.C., and finally to its latest residence.
The project itself, its home base is in Atlanta, and it's a huge, huge quilt. There are over 48,000 blocks in the quilt, so it's a massive physical size quilt.
Is it difficult then to ask for a loan out on things like World AIDS Day, which is December 1st?
Actually, it's very easy. They have all of their loan materials accessible online for any group that wants to borrow it. So I think part of their mission is to share these powerful tributes that people have created for people who have passed away from AIDS. So they make them very readily accessible for borrowing.
Now, the AIDS quilt is part of the NAMES Project as well. Is there an established sort of relationship, or how do you further that partnership with the NAMES Project at the MSU Museum?
Sure. The MSU Museum has been, for a number of years, interacting with the NAMES Project. We have a couple of research areas that have led to that. We do a lot of work with quilt study here at the museum, and we also have an ongoing project devoted to looking at the relationship between arts and health. And NAMES Project specifically, we've been a part of a grant where we are working to put each of those blocks in the NAMES Project quilt online through a project we do called the Quilt Index, which is a centralized online resource for all sorts of material about quilts from around the world. And we're working to have all of the quilt panels digitized and then the data entered and put online. And a really cool part about it is not just the data that's currently available. What has been found is as those blocks were created for the quilt as tributes, there was not always a lot of additional information beyond the physical creation collected. So what we're hoping happens is once these blocks are available on the Quilt Index, people can add more to the story about them. So it might be more information about who the block is playing tribute to. It's crowdsource type activity can add to it. Or the person who made the blocks, quite often the blocks are made by people with personal relationships, but at other points in time, on World AIDS Day, groups have had block-making activities where they've made blocks for people and added them to the quilt where they may or may not have known the person. So it could be someone writing the story about why they made this block, why they participated in an event type of thing. So any additional information to grow the data on the different blocks will be part of this ongoing digitization project.
So, as you say, crowd-based information gathering, is that some sort of Wikipedia model as far as people enter in that data?
Yes, very much so. It's people will be able to go and add much like they could for Wikipedia.
Now, if people wanted to go see the AIDS quilt panels December 1st through the 11th, when they're on display, where would they go?
They would go to the MSU Museum, which is located on the MSU's campus right across the street from the library and next to Beaumont Tower. You just go in, and they're going to be on display in our lobby gallery.
And this display is dovetailing very well with something coming up in January that'll be on display mid-January through July, I believe.
Yes.
What is that project, which also serves sort of underrepresented populations?
Sure. It's another quilt exhibit that's called Quilted Conversations Materializing Civil and Human Rights. And this is part of a project that we kicked off about a year ago where the MSC Museum has partnered with the Residential College for Arts and Humanities and the Office for Inclusion and Intercultural Initiatives, where we have been doing activities that use quilts to start dialogues about civil and human rights. So we have a very large collection at the MSU Museum about quilts that address human rights issues. So in some cases, we've taken those quilts out and had community dialogues where we've talked about the quilt and then had people start to use those as starting points for other conversations related to that issue. We've also had a community quilt making project where people have selected an issue important to them and then they've created a quilt block. Those are being stitched together to create quilts. All of those are going to be featured in this exhibit. So it's an exhibit where there are quilts from the museum's collection and community-made quilts that address civil and human rights. And we're hoping that people will come in and look at the quilts and use it as a starting point to think and have conversations.
We're speaking with Mary Worrell of the MSU Museum about a couple of upcoming quilting displays. First, panels of the AIDS Memorial Quilt, which are on display for a very short time, now through December 11th, as well as another display Mary co-curated called Quilted Conversations Materializing Civil and Human Rights, which opens mid-January and runs through the summer of 2017. And Mary, on the surface, you've discussed some, you know, frankly, rather heady concepts of social justice and struggle. How can something as seemingly simple as quilts do that? Are there any from the Quilted Conversations that might be a good example?
Sure. There are a number of ways. Sometimes someone is using the process of quilting as their own, I'm going to say, emotional release. So they themselves have been through something related to civil and human rights, and they use the process of quilting and creating the quilt as a therapeutic process. And in that case, it might be a visual that's obvious related to that, or it might have been the process itself that has helped that person address their issue. In other cases, someone is paying tribute. So for example, we have a number of quilts in the museum about Nelson Mandela. So people who want to pay tribute to an important figure have created a quilt that talks about them. We have a quilt in the exhibit that's about foreclosure and the housing crisis. And someone has taken a specific part of Flint and has mapped out all of the places that have been foreclosed in that area. And that's a visual representation. And the interesting thing I found with quilts, to using quilts as the vehicle to talk about human rights, is if you ask people if they've slept under a quilt, a lot of people have. And if you ask them to throw out a couple of words about what comes to mind descriptive-wise, when they think of quilts, they might talk about warmth or comfort or very happy feelings, a lot of family connections. And in this case, the quilt maker is quite often addressing something really hard to deal with. But I think because they're starting in this very familiar place and comforting place of a quilt, which is so familiar to so many people, they've used that to stretch and push people a little bit and then to take on something really big and important and use it as a means of artistic expression.
So as you talk about Flint, that's obviously an emerging situation as well. In part of the collection, do you have an increase of people addressing similar contemporary issues in the community?
Yes, because we know that, for example, more than one person has made a quilt about the water crisis in Flint, so the exact same community, and we're hoping that at some point we have one of those quilts in our collection. We don't just yet. As part of the collection and research process for all of our human rights-related work, we've been documenting a lot of quilts, so there's Flint, there's gun issues, there's education issues, there's marriage equality issues, and a lot of those are going to be in the quilts that we're including in the exhibit.
These exhibits will be on display at the museum, but if you want to find more information about other happenings at the MSU Museum, where would people, specifically online, where would they go
sure,
to find that information?
the museum's website. If you just Google MSU Museum, you'll find us. And if you're specifically interested in quilts, our website is quiltindex.org, where we have all of the quilts available online. And we also have a new publication called Quilts and Human Rights that has the quilts that will be in the exhibit, others from our collection, and others that we've researched around the world. We talk about them in that publication.
New publication as of when?
August of this year.
Mary Worrell is curator of cultural heritage at the MSU Museum. Thanks for speaking with us about the AIDS quilt on display December 1st through the 11th, as well as the upcoming Quilted Conversations, which launches in mid-January.
You're welcome. Thank you for visiting.
For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow on Current State, the City of East Lansing's financial health team has been hearing from citizens about how to tackle the city's long-term budget deficits. We'll get an update from team leader Mike Moquin. And our Live Music Friday guest this week is Monty Pride, a young Okemos-based musician who's released a new full-length album called Hawthorne Morning Sound. His influences range from Paul Simon to Iron and Wine. It's Monty Pride live tomorrow on Current State's Live Music Friday. We hope you can join us. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Kevin Lavery directed our show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Katie Cook, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. Stay connected with Current State on Twitter at KAR Current State and on Facebook at Current State from WKAR. See you Friday. It's Current State on WKAR.